If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
This time I did it that way. I did it with my partners, or I structured my life, my company around my life, as opposed to the last two or three businesses. You know, it was my businesses ran my life, and that was a huge difference.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Oh, man, that's great. The pleasure's mine. Can you give our listeners just a quick bio on yourself?
Sure. So I started in real estate investing 2007-ish, 2006. The world was ending. And I said, hey, this looks, you know, I was getting out of school and said, hey, I'm going to, you know, I read Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad. He flipped a house or wholesaled a house. And I said, I'll do that. Learned pretty quickly how to do it. It was actually harder back then to learn how to do it because like we didn't have all the resources that we have today. Yeah, I learned pretty quickly how to do that. Built a wholesaling company, one of the bigger ones in the Philadelphia region at the time. Then ended up just kind of through association building a property management company that rolled into that, which then I sold to an individual in Center City, Philadelphia now. And then from there, you know, I technically was unemployed, so I needed to do something. So I said, hey, I had some silent partners in the management company that, you know, I knew my market really well. I had done thousands of deals, so I understood like my market that I was in, and said, hey, let's take the hard money up from Maryland and let's start deploying it in our space. And then since then, you know, we've done thousands of deals, deploy about $40 million a year. And we're true private lenders. We're not institutionally backed at all. It's true private money.
Now that's interesting. You make it sound so easy, like, oh yeah, we did this, we did that. No, here we are. You know, it's I'm sure there's a lot of steps in between those.
A lot of lessons.
Yeah, a lot of things you learned along the way. I'm curious, you know, I always like to review the 08 period with investors. You had a wholesaling company and a property management company at that point in time. So on either one of those fronts, were you stuck holding the bag when the music stopped?
No. So wholesaling, the reason we switched over to property management was I saw a lot of people. You're talking about 2008?
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of people got hurt in 2008, but I was in two industries that really didn't carry much hard risk, right? So wholesaling being that I had assignment fees. I did learn how to build a business and learn what it was like to spend $30,000 a month on marketing and how, you know, how you get better close deals if you want to keep spending that kind of money. And that was maybe my biggest lesson there, was understanding how to structure and understanding overhead and spending and lead flow and all that kind of stuff was very integral in building that wholesaling company. And then as that streamlined into property management, the property management actually stemmed from everything stopping from what you're talking about, because there was all of a sudden this crazy need for all these people that were, basically what happened was in 2008, people had to make a decision. They were trying to become full-time investors and leave their 9-to-5. All of a sudden they lost all their equity. They had all their equity stripped out in 2008 and they were trying to hold on, and they realized they couldn't. So what they did, a whole lot of people did was they went back to get a day job to then take that money and put it into the rental properties to try to stay afloat. And all of a sudden there was this huge need for property management because all these people went back to their day jobs to keep their rental properties, you know, in place. It was like way too easy to get clients back then for property management. I was like, why isn't everybody doing this? But it was just a timing thing where there was a whole lot of people. So the clientele from when I started that company to when I sold it, you know, we started it and grew it to about 600 units. And then by the time I was done investing myself in that business, because when we sold, I retained some interest shares and came on board in a working capacity. We brought that up to like 3,000 units at the time.
Wow.
And the clientele from like 2008 was way different from the clientele in, you know, later on in the cycle, because one was in desperation mode. The other was in, where do I park my cash mode? You know? So it was two different types of property management, but I did not get left holding the bag because the nature of the businesses I was in didn't really carry any risk. They were just contracts.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's something people often overlook. You know, I always hear the value and the benefit of being the active investor or of, you know, being the direct sponsor. But I think there are ways to be involved that you can offset some of that risk. And I think some of the times, you know, people overlook that. They're like, oh, well, I don't want to be a broker. I want to be an active investor. It's like, well, yeah, the broker's also offsetting a lot of risk because, you know, they're getting paid regardless of what happens after you buy it. So that's fascinating. So at what point in time you sold the property management company, and then when did you launch into hard money? What year was that?
7 years ago into hard money. So I had some overlap with the property management company, like I was doing, you know, I was on like a consulting and I had some ownership interest at the time. And then, you know, we just parted ways because I outgrew it. I had unfinished business in my mind when I sold the company, and I was like, and I ended up selling it to a guy that, you know, his family owns 26,000 units across the country.
Oh, wow.
So like, I kind of wanted to jump into that circle and say, hey, what's it like to roll around with, you know, people that control billions of dollars of real estate. I didn't have that kind of access at the time. So that was an interesting experience in its own right. And, but yeah, so there was some overlap there, but I've been doing lending for probably about 7 years of that.
Okay. And what do you guys primarily lend on now?
I lend on a lot of single family, like fix and flips. But I also do, you know, as long as it's non-owner occupied, I'll take a look at it. You know, non-owner occupied commercial use is my space. So we'll do retail and stuff like that as well. Commercial pieces. I'm not afraid. I know my market well enough. I'm not afraid to get into that stuff. Even when COVID was hitting, I mean, everybody else went out of business. We were fortunate in the way we were structured that we survived COVID and thrived in it, because I got a whole lot of calls during the time. I was like, hey, are you still have money? You guys still lending? And it was like, yeah, doors are wide open. So, you know, during that time we got, you know, our business really stood the test of a cycle, which was very important. A lot of companies did not during that time.
Give us some insight on that. What you said, you guys, you know, you had some processes in place that allowed you guys to flourish in, you know, 2020. What does that mean?
Well, it was more about our underwriting initially, like that tests your underwriting. So, you know, I underwrite all my own deals. My partner underwrites all of his, and the reason we raised capital without taking bank money was very relevant at that time, because we really modeled our business after all the OG lenders in the industry. And they, you know, the ones that had survived multiple cycles, none of them took bank money. And bank money is very tempting because, you know, banks will give you money at, you know, 10 to 1 leverage at 3% interest. And, you're going, man, I can deploy that at, you know, 12 or whatever percent. And the problem was that got into a price war for a lot of people. And before you know it, people are lending at like 7 and 1. Well, there's no money to go around. Like, you know, as a lender, you're not making any money. So you need to do a whole lot of volume, which leads to a whole lot of questionable underwriting, which leads to a hiccup in the market like COVID. And all of a sudden banks get scared and pull all their lines. So all my competitors who use bank money, like overnight, it was, we didn't expect this, but overnight, you know, they had all their lines pulled. And and then we were like, okay, well, we were designed for this. We paid extra, you know, we paid a higher premium for our money, but it's private money. No, you know, we control our own capital and stuff like that. And okay, let's see if this stand, we did it for a reason, or we should have jumped in with some of that cheaper money. And it turned out it was the right decision. And that's why a lot of other companies survived. It really just had to do with the sourcing of our capital being a lot of our own personal capital, honestly. And then between that and then the way we underwrite, you know, and making sure we were in good deals, because the deals that happened a year ago were the ones that were going to test you. It wasn't the deals that were coming up during COVID. It was what's going to happen pre-COVID, you know, who can make payments and stuff like that. So our portfolio did really well, and means we did a pretty good job with our underwriting, which you really don't know until COVID or something like COVID happens.
What's the conversation like with a potential investor in your firm for you guys? Like, what is that structure, and how does that work for someone who is the lender to your company?
We don't do a fund. We do what's called a one-to-one model. So, you know, people will essentially, like if you were to come in and fund a transaction with us, you would be paired directly to the transaction. So your money is actually placed against the first lien position on the property. So where a fund model would be, everybody put a big pool of money together and then we'll deploy it as we CB, and we'll also take payroll out and we'll do this, we'll do that. We don't do that. It's literally your money goes to this deal, and then, you know, here you go, you're in first lien position on it. So that's the model we deploy. And we just found it works. It's cleaner for us in the back end. It's very transparent, highly transparent. And we've never had an issue with it.
Right, right. Yeah. From, you know, from my ignorant point of view, I would be like, gosh, that's a lot of, that's a lot of moving pieces at that point between the, you know, the lender and the borrower, and you guys are sandwiched in the middle. I guess you guys stay with it throughout the duration of the loan.
Oh yeah, we service our own loans, yeah.
Right, right. That's fascinating. What's it, and obviously you guys have built a large network of people that know you, that know your underwriting. So, you know, is there any challenge? Was there any challenge last year getting deals funded, or did people just say, yeah, you know, I know that Ian does a great job and sure, why not?
What do you mean?
Well, let's assume you get a borrower that comes to you and they say, hey, we need $2 million, Ian. You guys then have to go out and find that particular lender.
Oh, no, no, we have more money than we can deploy. So we, I mean, if we wanted to deploy, so when I say we deploy, we call it $40 million a year right now. In a blink of an eye, we could deploy 80. So in the beginning, it was very hard to, when you don't need money, you know, everybody's going to give you money. When you do need money, nobody wants to give you money. And, you know, in the very beginning, when it was originally started, to get $1 million on the, you know, raised it on the street was difficult. But now we turn money away because it jeopardizes the integrity of, like, we never have pressure. So one of my partners handles specifically the, I have no idea how much money is, you know, needs to be, like, he never calls me up and goes, hey, we need to deploy some of this cash. Mm. We never have the pressure on my end or my other partner's end to deploy. And it keeps the integrity of the underwriting in check, because once you get to pressure, like from like a bank or something like that, to deploy outwards, you start going, maybe we can squeak this one by, maybe we can squeak that one by. And all of a sudden you have a lot of chinks in the armor on a portfolio over the last year that you felt pressured to deploy. So we never have any kind of funding issues because there's too much money. And we just simply set the tone with people that we're not going to put your money on the street unless there's a real deal sitting here. Other than that, you're more than welcome to take your money and invest it somewhere else. But that's how we hold very tight to the integrity of our underwriting, because we don't want any headaches.
Right. No, no, that makes all the sense in the world. What are some things you're seeing right now that are kind of your large scale filters that you just say no to? Like what has to be on a deal?
Oh yeah. In general. So, yeah. I mean, most people don't have a deal in front of them. I tell people I'd fund every deal that comes, every single person that puts a deal in front of me, I'd fund if it was a deal. And the real red flag is people are overpaying or don't know that the value of the house on the resale value. So, you know, they think it's worth 300 in the fix up. I look at it and go, this thing's worth 200 in the fix up. You're buying it for 180. You're trying to put 50 in, you're underwater day one. So it's not, you know, so most people don't have a good deal in front of them, even if they think they do. The market right now is hot and it's going to need to cool off. I know interest rates went up a little. It needs to cool off again. It's the second cool off since COVID. It got too hot after COVID, before COVID, after COVID now. So right now I see people overpaying again. And, you know, I see comps going up though. Like there's a huge, you know, it's not just pockets of areas anymore. It's not just like when I pull up on the MLS and say, hey, look, you know, I can see this area is exploding. It's like everywhere you go right now, you've seen like a 10% appreciation in the last like six months or a year. I'm like, man, you know, who knows what's coming next, but it can't keep going this rate. It can't. So
how do you guys protect yourselves in that?
You know, we're always based, you know, we're always looking at the market saying, okay, a 35 or 40% drop, are we safe? And, you know, beyond that, nobody's got a business going on. So anyway, that's how we protect. We're very well insulated in that capacity, or we believe to be. I know in regards to anybody else lending in my area that we, you know, our portfolio is the most insulated. So that's how we protect against it essentially.
Right. And I guess the other thing is that if you guys are loaning in all cash, right? Like if you have nothing but private lenders and it's there's the private lender is the bank, and yes, foreclosure and, you know, taking the property back is certainly a viable possibility if the borrower defaults. Mm-hmm. But even so, there's not the bank issue. There's not the hair that goes along with a deal. It's probably a much cleaner transaction. You guys have more flexibility in your, you know, take back strategies if you had to.
Oh, take back. Contrary to popular belief, if you do your underwriting well up front, you don't have very many defaults. But yeah, I mean, we have very good attorneys. I mean, very good attorneys. So in the event that we get into that situation, I mean, we take back less houses than a bank, an actual A paper bank. But when we do run into that situation, you know, I would think we do it as efficiently as possible. Our attorneys are very good.
Sure.
So we pay quite a bit of money for, it's a place you do want to pay for an attorney. You know, some areas you can, you can skip by. That's not one of them.
Right. And I guess my point was that you guys have more flexibility than if you had borrowed, you know, lines of credit from a bank, and now you've got debt that you have to repay. You now have some flexibility with both the borrower and the lender to find a workable solution.
Yeah, we've got a little bit more. Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, banks can say, nope, you know, they're not even going to pick up your phone call, right?
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, we keep a very transparent, open relationship with our borrowers, both sides. You know, whoever, we keep it very flexible. And flexibility is a big part of, you know, why a lot of times things do work out well.
Yeah. Yeah. I can only imagine. I can only imagine. I've got a deal. Actually, it was my own hard money loan that I'd lent out, and it's not going as planned. And we've got the flexibility to work it out and, you know, kind of just tweak it to where, you know, eventually the whole thing will play out. But if, you know, if I were a bank or some other non-flexible institution, it would be, you know, a much harder deal for both ends. So that's very cool. What are some things maybe that you guys have done in the last 7 years that you would have done differently?
From a lending perspective?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I made one mistake and I paid for, or not, no, I mean, I'm sure I made many mistakes, but I made one mistake that sticks out. You know, we've never lost money on a house, and we've done thousands of transactions except for one. And I pay for it out of my pocket to make it right with the investor. And it was a lesson learned in that what I did, this is my mistake. What I did was I had a borrower I'd done a few deals with, and he had a few open deals with us. And I didn't check. I wasn't as thorough with the disbursement of construction on a particular portion that I should have been in my mind. And, you know, one of the most dangerous spots when you're lending is halfway done a construction job, mm-hmm. because to any other investor that's going to buy that house when you got to liquidate, they're going to go, might as well just rip it all out. Right. So that 30 grand of the 60 that you put into the house when it's still a drywall probably is still going to be paid for at an as is number. And so I had a scenario where the guy, you know, I realized he was robbing from Peter to pay Paul, and I was Peter. So he was paying Paul. Mm. And, you know, it cost me a couple bucks. It wasn't crazy. I mean, we got out okay, but, by okay, I mean, I didn't lose a ton, but the lesson was like, keep tight on the construction portion, because everybody's going to be asking you for money ahead of where they are. It's just the nature of the beast. And so when I see certain things going, hey, I have a $50,000 budget and I'm requesting 40,000 and we're up to studs, you know, big red flag, tighten up the reins real fast. You know, it doesn't happen that often, but when it does happen, I'm very aware of it now.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. You're right. Yeah, I've looked at plenty of projects, not so much recently, but maybe, 5 to 7 years ago that would come across my desk half finished, and just educating the people bringing you the deal that, look, this is worthless to me as a buyer, half done. Like you said, I'm going to tear this all out and just start over.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what they've done. I don't know what permits they've pulled. I don't know what their electrical's like or their plumbing is like, or I'm just going to send all my own guys in and we're going to start all over.
And if they're over budget, they probably cut a whole lot of corners anyway. So,
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's wild. So how many people are on your team? Can you speak to that? And then tell us what it's been like to scale your business and maybe some things you've learned along that journey.
We run lean. We definitely run lean for the size of our operation. We're probably the biggest lender in our area, and we keep, you know, we have probably like 10 people. Wow. And we try to keep it that way. We are not an overhead based. We stay lean because overhead means big bills in a downturn, and big bills means layoffs and infrastructuring and headaches. Honestly, like I come from backgrounds, like, you know, especially the property management field, where, you know, the moving parts and the amount of people and things that we had to put in place were just such headaches in turn. Like if you like that kind of stuff, that's the perfect world for it. But I was like, man, like there's so much management and departments and moving pieces. And it was very amazing to learn it all and do it all, but with everybody there, but it's like, there's so many moving parts. So it was a breath of fresh air coming into like, this is the leanest we could possibly run to be efficiently running this company. And that was, I enjoyed a whole lot more. I am not about being somebody's boss. I am not about managing. This not for me. You know, this ended up being, does that answer the question? I don't know, I just started talking about.
No, it's great. Yeah. You're giving a lot of good pointers there. I mean, because one, you're building a company the way you wanted to build it, which I think people often overlook. They come up with an idea and then all of a sudden.
This time I did it that way. I did it with my partners, or I structured my life, my company around my life, as opposed to the last two or three businesses. You know, it was my businesses ran my life. And that was a huge difference.
Right, right. But yeah, you have found a way to efficiently scale and still get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. Man, that's great. Anything else that comes to mind as you think about the last 7 years of growing this company that were some kind of key takeaways from that?
Honestly, just live lean. Like even when everybody's floating around with, you know, it looks like everybody and their mother's making all this money and they're spending it and they're growing their operation and taking on infrastructure and, you know, huge bills. Like we honestly, the real estate industry got away with one, aside from the commercial field in the COVID situation. Like we got by fairly unscathed, quite frankly. If you were in 2008, like that was a different story. So we really haven't seen. So anybody that thinks they just skirted a cycle, you know, like, oh, I can survive a cycle, it's fine. That was not a cycle. That was not a full real estate cycle.
Right.
So when that real estate cycle comes, you know, you're going to want to have lived lean at that moment. I think what this was, though, was for anybody that has not seen a cycle, got to see for about 2 months of COVID when everything was shut down, going, okay, trimming your bills. And what does that really mean? And then instead of hopefully what people will do is they will carry that forward and be like, okay, I got to get out of jail free card here and I can trim my bills and live this way moving forward. If you become extravagant and push your company to the edge in terms of, you know, bring in a million, spend a million, when you get a real downturn that lasts 6 months, 2 years, whatever, you can't survive that kind of nut. It just doesn't, you know, so that would be the only thing that I would say I'm very, very fortunate to experience it and be around.
Right, right. No, that's great. That's great input. I love that. Ian, let's jump here into the final four. What is one piece of advice that you would give to an aspiring investor?
Learn your market and learn to market.
That's great. That's great. What is one thing you are currently doing to stay on top of your game?
My routine and consistency are probably what keeps me in check every day.
Gotcha. And when it comes to giving back, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
From a business standpoint, I every day I go on one of my routine things is I go on one of the bigger forums and always give information out from like stuff that I've learned over the years. So it's like purely a give back. And from a personal standpoint, I tend to like to give people, you know, that are in need of, you know, homeless people and so forth. I like to give them things, you know, money and stuff every time I see them. I'm not one of these people that judges them or thinks, you know, get a job type thing. I'm whatever you got going on, man, it's probably worse than what I got going on. Here's, you know, and I'll give them whatever I got on me kind of thing. So that's just kind of my nature, I guess.
Right. No, that's cool. That's great. That's great. Ian, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Phone number is 215-839-3271. And my email is just my first name, IAN, at the bottom over here. Yeah. Ian at hardmoneybankers.com.
Awesome. Ian, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
All right. You got it. Take care.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.